We're dealing with a watershed that is controlled by a total of 31 states, a number of Indian tribes, a whole handful of federal agencies, all with different rights, duties, and expectations, authorizations, budgets, and cultures.
Mark Davis doesn't mix his words. As the director of Tulane's Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy, he's got to be precise when speaking with the public, especially when he's talking about the murky Mississippi River. Economic policy on the Big River was just one of the many issues discussed at the Anbaugh DeLow conference. Before the day was over, we'd hear about the Gulf, deteriorating wetlands, and rising tides. Sometimes it felt like more questions were raised than answered.
How do we take the next step? What happens if we do nothing? How do we try to balance coast, economy, and society as these decisions start to play out?
That's Denise Reed of the Water Institute of the Gulf. Her opening remarks paved the way for a handful of presentations from environmental agencies within the state. Although they represented different groups, everyone kept citing the same booklet, Louisiana's 2012 Coastal Master Plan. Within the master plan's 190 pages is an outline of the state's coastal investment over the next 50 years, projected to cost $50 billion. Future dollars are still up in the air, which has Steve Cochran of the Environmental Defense Fund concerned about the politics of water.
We have a plan that's based on the best science available that gets redone every 5 years so that new science, new understanding can be incorporated in it. That's part of the law. And if we can make sure that the politics can align with this longer term, we actually have a chance to get this done. Now, no politician ever wants to take the long view, ever. That's not cynical, that's reality. If you can find me one example, I'll change my mind. But I'm telling you, that's not how it works. We have to make it possible for the short-term interest of a politician to be our long-term interest.
But courting politicians isn't the only thing Steve advocates.
One of the things that I tend to say to audiences outside of here is, if you look at the maps, if you look at where the 60% of the grain that's shipped worldwide goes through, if you look at what the port provides, America doesn't have to help us do this, but they also have to come up with a wholly different way of transporting goods around the country.
Overlapping ideas emerged as the presentations continued. Politics, economics, and engineering were all hot topics, but nobody ignored the cultural lifestyle that's been put in jeopardy. Mark Davis even voiced his hope in the resiliency of Louisianans.
The entire idea that the communities in South Louisiana and the Gulf Coast are so rooted in places that it's unthinkable to ask them to change is an insult to our heritage. You know, to tell the Vietnamese, the Croatians, the Serbs, the Italians, the Irish, the Germans, that somehow or other you can't survive if we actually ask you to adapt is astounding when you consider the things they've already been through to be here. So I do believe that we can culturally make this leap.
Panelists suggested Louisiana must become a more interdependent state in order to solve its coastal erosion problems. The good news, if you can call it that, is that we're not alone. Here's David Muth of the National Wildlife Federation.
3 feet of rise in South Florida is the end for South Florida. They can't build levees. They're sitting on porous limestone. We have a river full of sediment that can build land. We actually have a solution that nobody else living on any coastline in America has. We just have to figure out how to tap it and use it.
The day of high-level discussion led to few answers. But the goal was to educate the public on some of the major ideas for managing Louisiana's water and to drive home the urgency to act. For WWNO, I'm Thomas Walsh.